Topic 1, Censorship of Obscenity, Part 3. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. In the first program in this series, we heard John French, former clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, discuss the constitutional standards surrounding censorship of obscenity. In the second program, Gordon K. Haskell, Director of Membership and Development, discussed the National ACLU position on censorship of obscenity. And Professor Edward Gerald of the Journalism Department of the University of Minnesota discussed a point of view arguing for moderation of the ACLU position. In this program, we hear the last of the speakers on this problem, Dr. Reynold Jensen, Chief of Psychiatry of the University of Minnesota Hospital, discussing the problem, is there a causal relationship between the reading of allegedly pornographic material and antisocial behavior? These discussions were part of a public meeting sponsored by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union on this problem. Dr. Jensen speaks from his 25 years experience as a child psychiatrist, drawing from his case study histories at the university hospitals over the years. And now, Dr. Reynold Jensen, Chief of Psychiatry, University of Minnesota Hospitals.
I'd like to start out by reading a poem from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, because I think it is important. Sometimes the poet catches something that others of us do not. There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he looked up and received with wonder, pity, love, or dread, that object he became. And that object became part of him for the day, or a certain part of the day, or for many years, or stretching cycles of years. His own parents, he that hath fathered him, and she that conceived him in her womb and birthed him, they gave this child more of themselves than that. They gave him afterward every day. They and of them became part of him. Excuse me. The mother at home, quietly placing the dishes on the supper table, the mother with mild words, clean her cap and gown, a wholesome odor falling off her person and clothes as she walks by. The father, strong, self-sufficient, manly, mean, angered, unjust, the blow, the quick, loud word, the tight bargain, the crafty lure, the family usages, the language, the company, the furniture, the yearning and swelling heart, affection that will not be gainsaid, the sense of what is real, the thought if, after all, it should prove unreal. Men and women crowding fast in the streets, if they're not flashes and specks, what are they? The streets themselves, and the facades of houses and goods in the windows. These became part of that child who went forth every day, and who now goes, and will always go forth every day. Now with this, I would like to make just a few brief comments. That obscenity and pornography is a primary causative factor in producing maladaptation or maladjustment or delinquent or antisocial behavior is an opinion that has been expressed many times. And I would remind us all that it is, as an opinion, it is an assumption. And unfortunately, in some assumptions, and much of our daily living is based on assumptions, but it seems to me that as I've listened to the discussion as it involves children, the stronger the person believes this assumption is a fact, the more strong feeling there is tied up in it. and this makes it difficult. Now, I would remind us that the influence of pornography and obscenity as being a primary causative factor in producing maladaptive behavior is an assumption. I would remind us further that there is no known reliable scientific studies to justify this assumption as a fact. And I would read from a paper recently published by Professor Brunninghausen, director of our school, library school at the university, and one of his students, a Mr. Fonts. This paper was published in the Journal of Experimental Education in the winter of 1964. Its title is An Exploratory Study of Juvenile Delinquency and the Reading of Sensational Books. This is what Professor Brunninghausen has to say. Over the last several years, Senate subcommittee hearings investigating juvenile delinquency have focused a great deal of attention on obscene literature. The conclusions the subcommittee has reached have been based largely on the testimony of expert opinion. Although the subcommittee did a good job of hunting for scientific studies aimed at discovering the relationships between obscene literature and behavior, their search was unfruitful. Such studies, for all practical decision-making purposes, did not exist. As recently as 1956, a note to the bibliography of a Senate interim report stated, quote, "There are no studies on the relationship of pornographic literature to sexual offense, although studies on pornographic literature and others on sex criminals occasionally have reference to the effect of such literature on the individual and on the sex deviate." Now, I could quote further, but I want to skip a bit here and read further from him explaining the reason for the lack of research in this area. He said, "The problem is a tough nut to crack. In view of the complex origins of delinquent behavior, the isolation of any single factor is difficult and perhaps impossible. There is probably no crucial experiment that will decide this issue. Only in an accumulation of research over the years will enable us to arrive at a more definite picture than the one we have at present." And then he says, "This study is one step in that direction." Now, in medicine, though we cannot always base our work on scientific experimentation, which establishes fact, we do have something that we call clinical experience, on which we base some of our tasks. Now, the field of pediatrics, and child psychiatry, and clinical psychology have been interested in the maturation of children, the factors and the forces producing them, for now about 60 years in this country. And it is their job to study case by case the important factors that may be instrumental in producing one kind of behavior in one child, another kind of behavior in another child. Now, what is the experience as reflected in the writing of the seasoned persons who have had years and years of experience in dealing with deviant or children who present deviant behavior? An English pediatrician originally published one of the first books in 1919. I have a copy of the fourth edition, The Nervous Child. There isn't one reference to any influence of pornography, of obscenity, in the index that would give me a reference to where to look in the text. The same can be said of Dr. Morgan's book, A Clinical Psychologist. The Psychology of the Unadjusted School Child, which was published in 1924. We have here The textbook, which is now in its fourth edition by Dr. Leo Connor, Professor Emeritus of Child Psychiatry of Johns Hopkins University, who published his original book in 1937. His fourth edition has just come out. There's not one reference based on his number of years of experience to suggest that obscenity or pornography are in any way a primary causative factor in the production of deviant behavior. Now, I'll not take up these other books. I'll just mention a few. The book that I read from first by Dr. Plant, Personality and the Culture Pattern, has no reference to it. This book was published in 1937. In 1948, Dr. Hale Shirley, professor of child psychiatry at Stanford University, wrote a book called Psychiatry for the Pediatrician. This book was completely rewritten and brought up to date in 1963. There's not one single reference to pornography or obscenity as being important causative factors in, resulting in deviant behavior. Balkin and Balkin, pediatricians, wrote their original book, Clinical Management of the Behavioral Disorders of Children, in 1953. It was rewritten in 1960, not a single reference. And the last two that have been published, recent date, a book by Dr. Stella Chess and Dr. Stuart French, one first published in 1959, and the latter in 1960, likewise have not a single reference. Now, each one of the individuals that I've mentioned here are outstanding authorities in the field of child psychiatry, pediatrics, or clinical psychology. They come from many different backgrounds. They've had many, many different experiences. And yet, it would seem to me that if writing textbooks, pornography and obscenity was important in the production of deviant behavior, they, as educators, would be one of the first to call it to the attention of their students. I've been in the field of psychiatry for the last 30 years. Of those 30 years, 28 has been spent in dealing with troubled and troublesome children. And I would concur in what is reflected in the books that I've just mentioned. Based then on clinical experience and careful studies of thousands and thousands of cases, I think one is safe in saying that obscenity and pornography cannot be regarded as causative factors primarily producing deviant behavior, nor are they contributing factors. Now, if we are really interested in our children and the welfare of our children, it would be more important for us to deal with things which need to be done and turn our attention to some of the things that we can do, and in doing them, perhaps will assure a better chance for children to mature in a more satisfactory way than some of them are at the present time. I would call your attention to a book that's recently come off the press, The Shook Up Generation by Harrison Salisbury. It was the headline-making book on juvenile delinquency and a Pulitzer Prize winner. One of the things that he says here, and I quote from him, "No, I think the origin of the shook-upness of our generation lies not in the international situation nor in the headlines of the tabloids. Such factors play no more than a secondary role. The source of disturbance is more prosaic. It lies in the home and in the community in which the youngster lives. It begins early in his life. It starts with lack of love and care and attention. There's nothing mysterious about it. In most cases, it can be detected years before the child's conduct has caused more than a trivial annoyance. Almost any good third grade teacher can point out the youngsters who will be adolescent problems. The child who's cared for does not become shook up. He and his friends may form a gang. After all, man has banded into groups for social purposes since early in evolution, and animals do the same. But it will not be in an antisocial nature. Even if he lives in a bad neighborhood, the boy from a good family does not usually get into trouble except by chance due to gang activities in the vicinity. I agree with Mr. Cingolani, who says from the depth of his own personal experience, and quoting, home is the root of 95% of the gang conduct and behavior problems. It is always true. If a kid doesn't get it at home, he goes to the street and gets it from the boys he finds there. When Mr. Cingolani was 10, his older brother came home from a tuberculosis sanitarium. The brother got all the family's attention. My father and mother didn't bring me into the picture, he remembers. They didn't tell me my responsibility. They were just terribly worried my brother would have a relapse. This led me to the street where the tough guys hang out. I had to be the toughest. It was the only way I could get any identity. The only way I could feel big was in the group. Whatever they did, I had to top it. No psychologist could give you a more succinct statement of cause and effect. I would call your attention to the tremendous shifts and changes that are taking place in our social order. It has been projected that by the year 2000, there will be 4 million people in the vicinity of the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul, stretching out in a 7-county area. It is projected by the year 2000, over 50% of our population will be concentrated in 3 areas in this country, one running from Boston, Massachusetts, down to the neighborhood of Washington, D.C., the second from Chicago on up to Detroit and around the lower portion of the lake to Cleveland, and the third extending from San Diego, California, to San Francisco and environs. What are we going to do with respect to planning Megatropolis? What in light of the horrible mistakes of city planners are we going to plan to make possible play, recreational areas, community centers, and so on, where children will have an opportunity to work off the raw animal energy that has to be worked off? What are we going to do about creating a more stable family life? It is a sad commentary on our society that 1 out of every 4 marriages ends in divorce, and the probabilities are that an additional family is broken but is staying together for some reason. And speaking from clinical experience, I can tell you that a situation like that has a devastating effect on the child as he struggles through the developmental years. What are we going to do about the dropouts? They can be spotted in the 2nd and the 3rd grade. Are we going to rest content to just let this problem continue to grow? Or are we going to find ways and means of providing the kind of curricula that children need to keep them in the educational system? And to provide monies to develop suitable curricula and train teachers and others? Mr. Salisbury has an interesting comment about what we can do. He says, and I quote, "There is a much closer relationship between adolescent delinquency and the child labor laws than is realized or willingly admitted by many social-minded people. These laws actually constitute a form of discrimination against the able-bodied boys who find it difficult to study and whose families are in dire need for their financial support." Now, what are we going to do about an extended use of our schools? Some places, they keep the kids in school until 5 o'clock in the afternoon rather than let them go through or let them out at 3:30. They do it to keep them busy, to keep them occupied, tire them out, as it's stated in one place. and in some instances, the schools are being more and more developed into community centers for activities that might provide constructive programming for children who otherwise might not have it. Well, it seems to me if we're interested in our children, their welfare and their future, which means our future, we ought to put first things first. There could be others mentioned. Now, I would just close by quoting Mr. Salisbury once more. Since October 1957, we have begun to realize with great urgency that Russian technology is moving ahead of our own. We have found that Russia is, in some respects, doing a better job of training our young people and of mobilizing our human potentialities than we are. Some of us have become increasingly aware of the weight of population reserves which Russia can bring to bear in an extended contest for technological superiority, her population being about one-third larger than ours. Despite all this, few people have yet begun to correlate the wastage and the deterioration of youth which we permit on the streets of the big cities, on the highways outside the suburbs, and I would suspect in the quiet rural areas of the nation with our national defense potential. I think without running the figures through an IBM machine that it is not difficult to foresee that the day lies not far in the distance when we are going to need every young talent we possess, whether it be one of manual dexterity or mental agility, to bolster our technology, industry, science, and defense against the greatest challenges of the age. The most rapid possible liquidation of adolescent delinquency and institution of a program to prevent its recurrence is thus becoming a matter of national security. If we've not been interested in doing this job for moral reasons, we're going to be compelled to do it for the sheer sake of survival. So the sooner we get going, the better. We're coming up to the time when the juvenile delinquency will be a luxury, which we no longer can afford. There's no question but that we can end it. But the rehabilitation of the shook-up generation is going to require some changes in us as well as the adolescents. Reno, the boys from St. Augustine Chapel down in Henry Street, put it with simple eloquence when he said, "If this present way of dealing with children or teenagers or kids, however you want to call them, is not changed to something with a little more respect to the fact that they are human beings, then this problem of juvenile delinquency will stay here and will plague this city for many, many, many years to come. If we wish our children to live in a humane world, we ourselves must practice the precepts of humanity." I don't know how many of you are acquainted with Gehiel Gibran's book, The Prophet, but I want to end with a statement that's made about children. And a woman who held a babe against her bosom said, "Speak to us of children." And he said, "Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not their thoughts. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the arrows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, he loves also the bow that is stable." I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, we ought to put first things first. Thank you.
That was Dr. Reynold Jensen, Chief of Psychiatry, University of Minnesota Hospital, speaking on the causal relationship between the reading of pornographic material in children and antisocial behavior. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. The American Civil Liberties Union, in their statement on censorship of obscenity, noted that most of today's pressures for censorship come from groups anxious about the impact of material on children. They say this is an area of understandable concern, but here too the assumed danger to sensitive minds must be measured against 1, actual evidence as to whether such danger is real, and 2, the damaging effect that general prescriptions on distribution to children will have upon the availability of controversial reading matter to adults. It is to this first point, that is, whether the danger is real, that Dr. Jensen has directed his remarks. We have found across the country, and working with the civil liberties problems involved in legislative censorship, that most of the proponents for some type of censorship of literature and other reading materials argue first and principally that this material adversely affects our children, that we must protect our children from this danger, and imply, if they don't state outright, that the reading of this material is harmful. Dr. Jensen discussed quite briefly a study done by Dr. David K. Berninghausen and one of his graduate students, Richard W. Fonts, on the study of juvenile delinquency and the reading of sensational books. Dr. Berninghausen, director of the library school, did this study, which was published in the Journal of Experimental Education, Volume 33, Number 2, in the winter of 1964. Since this was Minnesota-based and is one of the few studies directed at the question of whether reading of material by children causes delinquent behavior, it is worthwhile to spend a few minutes exploring the study itself and reviewing some of its findings. As Dr. Jensen pointed out, the study comments that the Senate subcommittee hearings investigating juvenile delinquency focused a great deal of attention on obscene literature. Dr. Berninghausen pointed out that such studies, for all practical decision-making purposes, do not exist, and that as recently as 1956, a bibliography in a Senate interim report reported, quote, "There are no studies on the relationship of pornographic literature to sexual offense, although studies on pornographic literature and others on sex criminals occasionally have reference to the effect of such literature on the individual," unquote. Dr. Berning points out that it's not feasible nor necessarily desirable that governmental activities be based completely on scientific findings. But he does say that it's unfortunate that our lawmakers were obliged to propose such legislation with so little to go on in this case. This is certainly the story behind most of the pressure for legislation to curb the right of the public to read or to see material as protected by the First Amendment in our Constitution. He points out that in the previous Congress, legislation was proposed to establish a commission to make scientific study to determine if there were a causal relationship between printed material and antisocial behavior. But the Senate Bill 162 eliminated that purpose and changed the commission, quote, "to explore methods of combating the traffic in obscene matter and materials, to develop a plan coordinating federal, state, and local efforts to suppress such traffic, to determine ways of obtaining public support of its suppression, and to secure the active cooperation of the mass media in accomplishing this objective," unquote. That bill was passed in 1961. It's unfortunate that the Senate cut off the mandate to the commission to explore whether there really is scientific evidence of whether there's a causal relationship between reading and antisocial behavior. But Dr. Brunninghausen points out that the reason for the lack of research in this area is clear, that the isolation of any single factor is difficult and perhaps impossible. Certainly Dr. Jensen's remarks point out why this is true in the area of delinquent behavior in children. The study itself, based its findings, or its method, on a study of delinquents incarcerated in state institutions. The entire population of children in our institutions in the state were studied, were sampled, of all between the ages of 14 and 17. Of approximately 130 boys in this age group, 39 were eventually included in the sample. Dropouts occurred mainly because of the school's work schedule, leaves of absence, discharges, and other reasons. So 39 boys incarcerated in state institutions for delinquent behavior were selected for this study. And they were matched against 39 boys who had not been adjudicated delinquents. Now, in the study, Dr. Brunninghausen refers to the reading of sensational books and points out that because the legal definition of a book is obscene is a matter that can be determined only by a court of law, and since none of the books in the study used had been so defined as obscene, it was deemed advisable by Dr. Brunninghausen and his associate to designate them by the non-legal term of sensational. The entire population of delinquent boys were evaluated at the school where they had been institutionalized. They were addressed as a group by the senior author of this study, who informed them that he was director of the library school of the University of Minnesota and that he was interested in books they liked to read. His introduction was purposely made general, but questions were invited from the boys and answered. After the introductory remarks, a reading checklist was distributed. This checklist consisted of 33 book titles, which were to be rated on a 5-point scale. The scale ranged from number 1, which was read the book and remembered it very well, to number 5, I'm positive I have never read the book. The checklist was explained to the boys, and the 5 response items were read aloud. Upon completion of the checklist, the boys were told that the study group might return sometime in the future and that they would be informed of the results. 12 days later, the school was again visited. The boys available at that time were divided into 2 groups, and the procedure of the first visit was repeated. The boys were informed they would be interviewed individually following the group session. Then they completed the same checklist used in the first meeting. In the individual interview, the boy was first given a multiple choice test on all the books he claimed to have read. Only books for which responses number 1 and 2 were given on the checklist were tested. That is, read the book and remembered it very well, or I read the book but I don't remember it too well. The test consisted of 3 paragraphs, of which only one was contained the book in question. Following the test, the boy was questioned about the books he claimed to have read. The interviewed boys were segregated from the others to avoid feedback contamination. Finally, when all of the boys had been interviewed, they were brought again together and given some general results of the first visit. They were then thanked for cooperation and dismissed. The non-delinquent sample was obtained by contacting the schools which each of the delinquents had been attending up to the time of his incarceration. 18 schools in the Minneapolis metropolitan area were contacted. At each school, delinquent boys were matched with boys who were presumably not delinquent. Matchings were made on the basis of age, grade in school, intelligence test score, reading test score, and father's occupation. The same procedure for obtaining checklists and interviews was carried out with a non-delinquent sample. However, many of these boys were tested individually, as opposed to the group testing situation of the delinquents. none of the non-delinquents was tested in a group larger than 7 persons. Now, the books on the checklist were divided into 3 major groups of 10 books each. They were categorized as adult books, boys' books, and sensational books. All the adult books were bestsellers. 9 of them were listed in Good Reading. The common element of the adult books is their erotically realistic writing. An erotic in this study was based on the definition of the Kronhausen's, quote, a truthful description of the basic realities of life as the individual experiences it, unquote. The 10 boys' books on the checklist were chosen for their popularity among teenage boys, as indicated by their listing in the Children's Catalog and the Children's Library section of the Library Journal. Recommendations were also made by a specialist in children's literature. It was not claimed that in all of these books were completely devoid of erotically realistic writing. As a group, however, they probably have much less writing of this type than the adult books. The other 10 books were classified as sensational. The major theme in these books is one of sexual sensationalism. Topics covered range from gang rape, flagellation, and endless repetitions of coitus to a wide variety of perversions. They did not appear to fall under the Kronhausen's definition of erotic realism. Some of these titles were suggested by juvenile delinquents, while others were judgmental choices made by the authors. 3 additional book titles were completely fictitious. They were devised as a check on the validity of responses. A second classification of the same books was made. In this classification, an attempt was made to select a group of books that was completely devoid of any sex references, although references to crime and violence might have been made. 7 of the boys' books were judged to fall in this category. These books were considered, in quotes, pure enough, even for the most avid Puritan, as far as sexual references were concerned. This group of books was labeled probably not erotic. In summary, the books were categorized in 2 different ways. First, they were grouped as boys, adult, or sensational books, according to the criteria just discussed. Then they were regrouped into a dichotomy which contained 7 books which were called probably not erotic, and 23 books which were called possibly erotic. These groups are, of course, not independent in that the same books were involved. Both methods of grouping are open to criticism of subjective judgments. No doubt other groupings could have been made depending on individual predilections of people doing the judging. The multiple choice test was devised following an approach suggested by Durost. The main idea involved in constructing the test was to make it so easy that even a cursory reading of the book in question would enable the respondent to get the right answer. A sample item is given. For instance, the questions given for John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. A. The Ash girls were laying out their dinner on the blue grass under a spreading oak. Fremont walked by as near to them as he dared. B. Highway 66 is the main migrant road for the Okies. 66, the path of the people in flight. Refugees from dust and shrinking land, from the thunder of tractors, from the desert, the winds and the floods. Or C. I'm going to kill a man. I don't know his name. I don't know where he lives. I have no idea what he looks like, but I'm going to find him and kill him. Subjects were asked to indicate which paragraph came from the book. Only books marked 1 and 2, remember it very well, or read it but don't remember it too well on the checklist were tested. Test responses were read to the subject if any reading disabilities were apparent. An approach to validating the test was made by obtaining reading cards from a non-involved high school library and testing boys whom it was certain who had read the book. At least it was certain that they had taken it out from the library. 66 responses were obtained from 15 boys. 64, or 97% of the responses given, were correct. It should be noted that only 9 boys' books and 4 adult books were involved. No sensational books were found in the school library. In addition, background data on these boys were missing, although the scholastic reputation of the school almost assures us that it was a biased sample in terms of intelligence and reading ability. An attempt at a more vigorous validation of the test seemed beyond the scope of this present study. It is difficult to see how it could be biased for or against either the delinquent or the non-delinquent group in view of the close matching on the variables previously mentioned, including intelligence. In discussing the interview, it's pointed out that a standardized procedure was used, which allowed the boys to, in quotes, chicken out gracefully on any false claims. The procedure also offered the boy a chance to add titles that he may have been hesitant about checking, but which he had actually read. In addition to administering the test, the interviewer asked some probing questions to try and determine if the boy had actually read the book. For example, did you see the movie? Did you see it on TV? Have you read the comic book? Have you read any other books by the same man who wrote this book? Do you remember what the book looked like? At the end of each interview, the interviewer had made a judgment as to whether or not the boy had, in fact, read the books. The chi-square test for matched pairs was used to test the number of boys in each group which had read books of each type. The number of boys which was tested rather than the number of books read because of the fact that the same boy could be represented in each category. In the results, matching for school attended was 100%. Fathers' occupations did not lend themselves to any adequate statistical treatment. None of the interviewers estimated that any of the boys had read the fictitious books used as a validity check. Only two of the delinquents and three of the non-delinquents claimed to have read one of these books on one of the checklists. When tests were made using the possibly erotic versus possibly not erotic breakdown, similar results were obtained. That is, no significant differences were found for the number of boys reading probably not erotic books. If the various definitions of books used in this study are accepted, then the hypothesis that there is no relationship between delinquency and reading of sensational books would also have to be accepted. Points out that this is one of the few studies in this area which deals with book reading. Most previous studies of the reading habits of juvenile delinquents have dealt with comic books or picture books, not books that must be read. Several studies have suggested that the reason for the lack of research is the generally poor reading ability of disturbed children, and the delinquents in this study conform to those findings. That is, they were below the mean on the national norms of reading tests. In summary, no significant differences were found between the two groups for the number of boys reading books classified as sensational books or boys' books. A significantly greater number of delinquent boys was found to have read two or more adult books. Within the limitations of the study, it was concluded that more delinquent boys appeared prone to read adult books with erotic content than were non-delinquent boys. These books were not of the sensational or the type of book which is usually considered or alleged to be obscene, but appeared to reflect the reading interests of the general adult public. In short, the study shows that with serious limitations, delinquents tend to read more adult books than non-delinquents, but that delinquents do not read more sensational books than non-delinquents. If you would like more information about the ACLU position on censorship of obscenity or on the materials or speakers in this series of programs, we invite your comments and inquiries. Send your name and address or your letters to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, 925 Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's MCLU, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. This is the 14th in a series of educational programs produced by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union as a public service.